for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Higher education has become a $420 billion industry in America. Charges at both public and private colleges have more than doubled in a generation. Young people increasingly graduate with six figures of debt. In this hour, two professors present their ideas on how to get more value for your tuition dollars. Andrew Hacker joins us in the studio. He's co-author of Higher Education with a Question Mark. Mark Taylor joins us from a studio at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. He's written a new book titled Crisis on Campus. And throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your thoughts on the issue. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Andrew Hacker, Mark Taylor, good morning to both of you. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Mark Taylor and Andrew Hacker, you both have real doubts about the current state of higher education. Let me start with you, Andrew, and ask you to talk about your question mark and your doubts.
Diane, our chief concern, and by the way, mine's a co-authored book with Claudia Dreyfus, who writes for the New York Times. Our concern is with undergraduate education. We really believe they're at the end of the queue. Research, consulting, athletics, and professor sabbaticals all come before the undergraduate experience in the classroom. We think that should be changed. It has to be changed.
And for you, Mark Taylor.
Well, first of all, Diane, thank you very much for helping to bring this crucial issue to the attention of people. I don't think it's yet getting the attention that it deserves. I do think the situation is critical in many areas, and I agree with Andrew that undergraduate education is very important. I also think, though, and perhaps we can talk about this, that reform must also include graduate education, because that is where undergraduate education is framed. The problem, as I see it, is that we're not fulfilling what I think should be the purpose of higher education. And that purpose, I believe, is at least twofold today. We should be training our students to learn and think critically and creatively in both traditional media and new media. And we should be helping them develop knowledge and skills relevant for life and work in the global world of the 21st century. And all too often, we're failing to do that.
And Andrew Hacker, you say colleges should be making their undergraduates more interesting people.
Yes. You know, and you begin to ask, how do you make somebody interesting?
Exactly.
You know, well, you give it a try. One way is you expose them to interesting people, to professors. And the problem with today's professors, I'm afraid I'm talking about my colleagues, is they're not very interesting. They're very dull. They're deep in their disciplines like, sociolinguistics or deconstructive criticism. They feel that the knowledge they had to study as graduate students is what undergraduates have to know. That's absolutely wrong. There's something called the liberal arts, which is having an informed, thoughtful conversation about the world.
And again, you're talking primarily about undergraduate education, where Mark Taylor, who is chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University, he's professor of philosophy of religion at Union Theological Seminary and professor emeritus at Williams College. He is thinking as well about higher education than undergraduate. graduate school. So both of you have concerns about the way our young people are going through higher education. Mark Taylor, what are your concerns regarding tenure and sabbaticals?
Well, first, a qualification, and then I'll address this important issue.
Sure.
It's very important to understand the complexity and diversity of the higher education environment. That is to say, the liberal arts are absolutely crucial. Having spent 37 years teaching at Williams as a leading liberal arts school, I've devoted my life to that. But that's only a very, very small portion of the overall landscape of higher education. Indeed, the number of students that the percentage of students in post-secondary education that fall into the category that we ordinarily think of as traditional, that is 18 to 22 year old students, is only about 16%. So there's a lot of, from junior colleges to other kinds of colleges, we have to understand that all of these students have different kinds of needs that need to be addressed in different ways. Now, I quite agree that the issue of tenure is problematic for many reasons, and I've been arguing for many years it should be abolished. In fact, it is waning. Only about 30 to 35% of the positions now in higher education are tenure or tenure track. Part of the and the reason I think tenure is a problem, and I think Andrew agrees with me on this, is that when you have tenure, you lose both carrot and stick. It's very, very difficult to create any kind of significant change or reform when you have tenure in place. I also think that it's very difficult to anticipate the relevance of a person's work over a lifetime.
And, Mark, you also advocate mandatory retirement.
Yes, these are things that make me very, very popular around campus. But I do believe that mandatory retirement would help for a variety of reasons. It's important to realize that there was mandatory retirement in the university until 1994, so it's not like we'd have never had it before. And one of the problems that you have at the graduate level is that there have been very, very, very few positions for graduate students in many of the fields, in the arts, humanities, and many of the social sciences, ever since 1970. And that has been exacerbated by the reluctance of people to retire. I should also say that I think that the alternative that we now have between tenure on the one hand and adjuncts on the other hand, there's a proliferation of adjuncts who are brought in on one, maybe two-year contracts. They are paid anywhere from only $1,000 to $5,000 a year per course. I think there needs to be a middle ground, and what I think should be done is that we should move away from tenure and move toward seven-year renewable contracts.
Andrew Hacker, you have some disagreement.
Well, sure, it's easy to be against tenure. I gave it up. I simply said to my administration, I don't need it, and I don't have it anymore. It seems to me that there are plenty of star professors around who could take a good first step by going to their presidents and saying, I don't need tenure. From now on, I want to be on an annual contract.
But short of that, why was tenure established in the first place? Why do you now believe tenure is no longer critical?
Actually, it's interesting, Diane. Tenure was originally set up not on for matters of academic freedom. That's a whole other story. But rather, they began to say, there's a certain point, we can't get the professors we want paying what we do unless we give them this fringe benefit, kind of civil service fringe benefit called tenure. And the thing got entrenched. And we now have 300,000 professors with lifetime employment. My chief objection to it is that, and I agree with many of Mark's, I really do, that it stultifies young people. They have to be cautious, they have to be controlled, they have to be correct until they finally get the golden ring. And by that time, at the age of 40, they've run out of ideas.
Andrew Hacker is a professor at Queen's College. He's co-author with Claudia Dreyfus of a new book titled Higher Education, with a question mark at the end. Mark Taylor is professor emeritus at Williams College. He's the author of Crisis on Campus, a new book just coming out. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Do join us on Facebook or Twitter. Andrew, the price tag for higher education these days is totally out of control. Why is that?
Yes, it's a typical private college. It's now $40,000 for what they call tuition. This is before you get meals or a mattress, travel or books. $40,000.
Per semester?
No, per year.
Per year.
$40,000 per year, which is more than many families make. Now, how has it got this high? Well, there's been tremendous bloat. Professors are now being paid six-figure salaries, as Mark is fond of saying, for just a couple of hours in the classroom, and I happen to agree with him there. We have more administrators than ever before. We have money-losing athletic teams. But what's also been the case is that the colleges have raised their tuition on the expectation the students will take out loans. And now 60%, it's actually over 60%, of students leave with indebtedness, and that's immoral.
Andrew Hacker, professor at Queen's College, co-author with Claudia Dreyfus of Higher Education. And when we come back, we'll talk about whether everyone should go to college. Two guests join me in this hour, Mark Taylor. He's chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University, professor of philosophy of religion at Union Theological Seminary, professor emeritus at Williams College. He's the author of Crisis on Campus, a new book about to be published. Here in the studio, Andrew Hacker. He's a professor at Queen's College, co-author with Claudia Dreyfus of Higher Education with a question mark. And we'll open the phones very shortly. First, I'd like to ask you both, starting with you, Professor Taylor, should everyone go to college?
I do not think it's necessary for everyone to go to college. I do think it's very important for everyone to continue their education throughout their lifetime, and I think we should not make the mistake of confusing the two. Indeed, for many, I think there has been an inflation of credentials very often in which people are required or expected to have college degrees for positions that don't really require them. On the other hand, and this is a critical issue, and I think it's one that Andrew and I may differ somewhat about, new forms of technology are going to make it not only possible but desirable for people to continue education in a variety of ways without having to take up residence at a particular college or university.
All right,
that's going to explode.
Yes, let's get into that. But first, to you, Andrew Hacker, should everyone go to college.
No, I wouldn't make it required the way we make seventh grade required, of course. Everyone, of course, should have the opportunity to go to college if they want to, and if we made education interesting.
And affordable,
thank you, both together. If we made it interesting and affordable, we would really make learning something that's part of an experience that everyone in the population could have.
You know, in the prior hour of this program today, we talked about home ownership and the fact that we can no longer see that everyone should own a home, but rather that shelter be available. In the same way, can we not look at education, Professor Hacker?
No, I disagree on that. Home ownership, we're talking of, you know, a huge house, physical thing. I teach at a city college in New York, a public college. No dormitories, everybody commutes and so on. My friends ask me, your students out there, are they any good? And I'll tell you my reply. I make them good. And you can do this. Everybody's got a mind, an inquiring intelligence. Let's put it to work and develop them.
Now, would you agree with Professor Taylor that with the expansion of technology, perhaps there will be alternative ways of learning rather than in the classroom?
Well, in our research, we took a trip down to the University of Florida branch, which is very high tech, in which 1,400 students take a class in the arts. No professor, no classroom, all in front of a computer screen. We lay it out. We have something of an open mind. We'll say, let's see what we can do with this. I still believe one-on-one, a teacher visibly looking students in the eye, it can't be beat.
What do you think, Professor Taylor?
I think several things. First of all, I think it is, though it may be desirable to have a one-on-one situation looking students in the eye, it is simply financially impractical, practically impossible in the world in which we are now moving. So the question I have is how can we develop ways to educate students in the areas that we think are important in a very, very difficult environment? Over 12 years ago, I started a company with some people in New York called Global Education Network, in which we attempted to develop a program to present high-quality online education in the liberal arts, humanities, and sciences at a low cost to people all over the world. There is enormous possibility in this. Is it the same? No. Is it different? Yes. Are there other possibilities that are opened up by these technologies? Yes. But in my experience, and this goes back 20 years, the reluctance of faculty members, and it is faculty members, I am disappointed to say, to explore the creative possibilities of these alternative media is self-defeating.
Tell me more about that, because it was your venture into for-profit education, Professor Taylor.
Correct. It was for profit in a very, very important way. Our goal, what we tried to do, was to establish a partnership with the leading colleges and universities. We were hoping to have 8 to 10 charter members who would be partners in this venture to develop high quality education. I saw these problems coming as 10 or 12 years ago, and the costs, not only as Andrew suggests, but if you project the costs out by 2028, 4 years of college is going at a leading school are going to be almost $600,000. There have to be ways to deliver education more in more cost efficient ways.
But surely we cannot project to that extent, Professor Hacker.
Absolutely. College doesn't even have to cost as much now as it does, with all the Club Med amenities, with the administrators, with the athletic facilities. Princeton University just put up a $45 million football stadium that will be used five times a year. Now, instead of charging $40,000, they could charge $8,000. My college charges that, and we're taking in, by the way, public subventions. This is not just on the cheap. Just why not make the purpose of higher education education?
What about Williams College, Mark Taylor?
Well, it's very. I mean, I agree with Andrew on this. As I speak here at Williams today, by coincidence, the U.S. News and World Report annual rankings come out, and once again, Williams is ranked number one. One of the problems, I think, is that we have set up a competitive system, and part of this is, as Andrew suggests, facilities and building and the like. The problems of higher education are systemic. We have to understand higher education as a national and indeed as a global system. Colleges and universities cannot solve these problems on their own. What has to happen is that rather than competing, institutions from the local to the global should be cooperating. We should not be in this arms race, whether it's building or whether it's for so-called star professors and the like. There are ways of cooperating because we're all in this together. And there is a huge divide between the haves and the have-nots in the world of higher education. Some places like Williams and Columbia, professors teach very little and have all these sabbaticals. At other places, many, many places, faculty are teaching 8-10 courses with 300 students and no TAs. They don't have time to read a book, let alone publish it.
Now, tell me what the current tuition is for an undergraduate at Williams College, Professor Taylor.
I'm not sure how the tuition versus overall
market. It's about $40,000.
Right. The overall cost is about $52,000.
And that would be including
room and board.
And board.
Right.
That's just really staggering.
It's staggering.
How does a student without enormous financial means go to a college like Williams without either huge loans, parental backing, or going into debt for the rest of his or her life?
One can't. And the other issue in this is to understand that the financial problems are not only for the students and their families, but also for many of these institutions. Now, Williams is a wealthy institution, but for many of these colleges and universities, they are under enormous financial pressure. And that problem is significant. A recent survey by the Chronicle for Higher Education of 700 colleges concluded that using the Department of Education statistics, two-thirds were on the brink of financial failure. Two-thirds. So the resources for financial aid are declining at precisely the same moment that the cost of education is escalating.
So, Professor Hacker, what would be your first radical change for a higher education?
Okay, nice question. And by the way, if they are on the verge of failure, it's because they've been spending like drunken sailors. You know, I don't feel one bit sorry for those colleges. Now, my hour, because this is Claudia and me together, every comma and semicolon we agree on in this book, everything other than classroom laboratory instruction should be put on the defensive. Defend yourself. Why does University of Southern California need a golf team which costs $32,000 per student per year? Why does NYU have to have a branch in the Persian Gulf? Why is it that Duke University has over 200 people in its athletic staff? Here's a job called Director of Collaborative Engagement at one university, another Coordinator of Learning Immersion Experiences.
So what you're saying is you would take higher education back to a primary form.
That's right. A classroom, a human teacher, no PowerPoints, no laptops, thank you. But we won't get into that now.
Professor Taylor, what about you?
Well, here's where we disagree significantly. What I would do first is to completely restructure the curriculum. The problem isn't just that what we are teaching is unavailable to them. The problem is that we are not teaching our students in ways that prepare them practically for the world they are going to live and work in. We need to restructure their curriculum. At the end of that process, I would hope to get rid of departments and to reconfigure it completely, but that's not going to happen in the near future. So we have to find new ways of creating new areas of inquiry. I call them zones of inquiry.
Would that include vocational education?
Some of it would, but some of it would. I think it's. I think that all education must justify itself to some extent in practical terms. That does not mean that all education has to be training. I happen to think, as a lifelong liberal arts teacher, that there is enormous practical value in the liberal arts, and nowhere more so than in today's world. Where knowing about other cultures, other traditions, knowing history is crucial. But the argument has to be made on the basis of the practicality of this for the young person. And we have to create new areas of inquiry that cut across traditional disciplines, because the levels of over-specialization create a lack of discussion. When I went to Columbia originally, in my department of religion of 10 people, we had 8 subfields. And those subfields are as separate as philosophy and history. We have to create lines of connection. We have to move from silos to webs.
Mm. Mark Taylor, he's chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. As you can imagine, we have many callers, many emails. Let's go to the phones. First to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Diane, I've been trying to get on for so long, I never thought I would.
I'm glad to have you with us.
Let me say this. I think this discussion is a Nobel Prize-winning discussion. When I was graduated from college, I came in out of debt. I was fortunate enough to be able to do things that when I graduated, I had $300 in the bank, and I bought my first car then. When my kids graduated from college, they went to school and got their master's degree by themselves. We did not help them except for just minor little things. We turned them loose and said, if you want your master's, go get it. My grandsons are both graduates of college now, and both of them had huge debts that it'll take them 20 to 30 years to pay off. Mm. And that's just not right. Let me give you an example. I don't want to name the university, but there is a private university that I'm aware of where the president of the university gets paid the equivalent of $4,000 per student per year. That is simply wrong.
Well, what about salaries, Professor Hacker?
Well, full professors are now getting six-figure salaries, even at small colleges, you know, that aren't that well known. It's a really cushy life. It's you teach, 30 weeks a year. Long summer vacations. Many cases, you don't spend that much time revising your courses. Now, to say the salary should come down, all I can simply say is at least they should be brought up, especially among the adjuncts that Mark Taylor talked about teaching assistants who do so much of the work direct with the students. So I would put, let's say, a ceiling on some professor salaries, and a floor should be raised for others.
And what about presidential salaries, Professor Taylor?
I agree that in many cases they are out of control. And in addition to this, I think that a lot of attention often gets directed toward the faculty, but in the last 10 to 15 years, there's also been an enormous growth in administration and staff at many institutions, and I think probably in a lot of cases you could cut the staff and administration in half and nobody would notice the difference. I do want to say again that it's important to understand the diversity and complexity of the higher education world. As I began speaking out and writing about this, I received many, many communications from very dedicated teachers working under impossible conditions and making very, very little money. It's not just the adjuncts are not making money. Yes, it is the case that in a certain number of schools, there are a significant number of faculty members making $60,000. But even at Columbia, I have 40 and 45-year-old young men and women with families trying to live in New York City on a salary that is simply not sustainable. So it's complicated, and we need to look at the full range of problems that higher education is facing.
Mark Taylor, he's the author of a new book titled "Crisis on Campus," and Andrew Hacker. He's a professor at Queens College in New York, co-author with Claudia Dreyfus of a book called Higher Education, with a question mark at the end. And obviously many of you have questions about the worth of higher education these days, considering how expensive it is. We'll try to get to as many of you as we can after a short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
It seems like happiness.
We lost a great jazz singer Saturday when Abby Lincoln died at the age of 80. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to an interview with her. Join us.
He's got a smile that makes the light.
Now we'll go right back to the phones for your questions as we talk about issues in higher education, certainly the cost, but also the quality of teaching. Let's go to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Dane. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Gentlemen, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to offer a perspective from a recent graduate. I'm actually in my last semester doing a senior project for my final three credits of school. You know, I agree with so many things you said. I went to a large state college out of my home state, and that's another issue that hasn't been brought up yet is, you know, transferring states and the costs in different locations of the United States. You know, I feel as though we shouldn't be confined to just the state we are brought up in, and it should be, you know, reasonable across the United States. Another comment, I created my own curriculum in college because I didn't want to follow the curriculum set for me. So we have a very good individualized major program, and trying to escape this non-caring faculty proved to be, you know, futile. Everyone I really dealt with, except for a lucky few members of faculty, lucky for me, they were very interested, and luckily they were very close to me during my education. But as a whole, they were not interested. Research came first. It was pretty sad. So I just wanted to offer the perspective of someone in it right now with $120,000 in loans to pay off.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. And
it's
tough,
Dane. And what are your prospects for employment, considering the creation of your own curriculum?
Well, my curriculum is based in freshwater resource management, and one of the reasons I chose that is to take advantage of the market that's there for, you know, that industry.
Sure.
I kind of smelt out the green kick that everyone was going on, and you know, I want to do some good and make some money. So, I tried to go a more scientific route. Usually these majors are arts-based. There's lots of theater. And
sure. Yeah. Well, I certainly wish you all success. Professor Hacker, talk about his comments about escaping from a non-caring faculty.
That's fascinating, Diane. Both you and I together wrote that phrase down in our notes, non-caring faculty. And then Dane went on to say it's because they're so wrapped up in the research. Now, I think now Dane has given us an opportunity to put this in perspective. This so-called research that professors are doing, 9/10 of it isn't needed. Yeah.
But they're forced to publish.
Well, currently we have 500,000 people who have various professorial ranks, get sabbaticals, and feel that they have to publish something. Do you know, in a recent 15-year period, there were 3,200 papers on Virginia Woolf written. Should I say it again? 3,217 publications on Virginia Woolf. Now, come on. Is that research? Is that knowledge? Is it needed?
And, Professor Taylor, to what extent does that research at institutions of higher learning take away from that individual face-to-face learning that a student like Dane craves but cannot get?
I think to a significant degree it takes away. Another way to make the same point is that teaching is just undervalued in our society as a whole. And one of the things that I often say is that teaching is nowhere more disdained than at a research university, where status is often measured by how little you teach.
Does that mean then that one of your recommendations would be to go to a small college that does not have a research university at its head?
Yes. Whenever, this makes me popular at Columbia, but when
I'll bet.
Whenever young people ask me about for recommendations about their undergraduate education, if they're interested in more or less the arts and humanities, I always say go to a good small liberal arts college. But I also think that measures need to be taken. Again, there's a trickle-down impact on the liberal on the colleges from the graduate level. You're not going to affect significant change at the undergraduate level alone without also changing the way in which education is conducted at the graduate level. So we need to change the structure of graduate programs to move away from over-specialization. We need to begin to value teaching in many instances as much as research. I think we need, and one of the proposals I make in the book is I think we'd in a national program to reinforce the value of teaching. I propose the establishing of a national teaching academy that will allow the cooperation between the have and have-nots to elevate the status of teaching at the college level, because as it now stands, it is not a significant factor in hiring, in tenure and promotion decisions.
Professor Hacker.
Well, Claudia and I disagree on this matter of graduate education.
Interesting.
We really think it's rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. We're concerned with undergraduates. And by the way, good teachers can come from anywhere. They don't have to come from PhD factories.
But what would you do? Take a university like, for example, the University of Chicago. Mm. Would you totally separate the undergraduate school from the university?
You know, it could well be done. There are plenty of very good colleges that don't have graduate schools, and in many cases, there's very little contact between graduate schools and undergraduate. But let me add something about where you can get a good education. And this was something we found and surprised us. Virtually every state university has within it an honors college. We found one at the University of Mississippi, at Arizona State.
There is one at the University of Maryland.
Absolutely, where you pay in-state tuition, and the professors who congregate, who come to, volunteer for these honors colleges, really care about teaching, get to know the students. So we advise kids and their parents, look for those colleges. They're there, and you don't have to pay Williams tuition there.
What do you think, Professor Taylor?
I want to comment on this issue of research a bit more, because there are excesses. There's no doubt about that. But it would be a big mistake simply to try to paint everything with the same brush here. The important role that research has played in many of our major research universities for the economy as well as for the world is absolutely critical. I also think that while it is the case that we may have too many articles on Virginia Woolf, it is also the case that research and teaching can and should, in my judgment, and certainly in my own case, be complementary. My research is always, my writing has always been an extension of my teaching, and my teaching an extension of my writing. Are there abuses? Yes. But you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Let's take a caller in Brownsville, Vermont. Good morning, Gretel.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to let everybody know that your two guests are talking about going to university and the value of going to university, and that sometimes you can extend your learning without needing to go to university. And there are two things that I access a lot, and one of them is called iTunes University.
Right.
And it's connected with Berkeley and MIT and some...
Oh, dear.
Some other large universities. Berkeley is discussing Richard Wright's Black Boy. MIT has lectures on chemistry. And this is all over iTunes. Another one is something called Khan Academy on the Internet, which it's a fellow from India who's developed courses from basic algebra through differential equations, physics, chemistry. Mm. And these are all courses that one can do at home and maybe test out of a lot of stuff if you decide to go to college, or if you don't, keep yourself in touch with what's going on.
I think that is just great news, and I think you've brought to the attention of a great many of our listeners options that are out there. Thank you so much. Let's go now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Ray. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning,
sir. I'm a 30-year engineering professional and a 23-year adjunct in engineering technology, and there's a couple points missing in the conversation.
All right.
From my perspective.
Sure.
One is one of the issues with university, even community college education now, is the qualifications and foundation of the students entering today. That graduating high school seniors are not at the level that they used to be, and a lot of remedial programs in math and reading and language are taking up time when they should be doing college-level education. As far as the costs for college, I teach at the University of Cincinnati, which has a 100-year history of cooperative education, where our students in several of the colleges are actually required over the course of their four-year degree to pursue 6 quarters of professional work in their field.
Hmm.
Which allows them to help offset their college costs, to become hands-on experienced professionals, and to start to develop employment opportunities for themselves by the time they graduate.
That's just great. Professor Taylor, talk about high school preparation first.
Oh, I think the point is very, very well taken, and I think the problem is getting more serious as the years go on. Many of my students at the undergraduate level, even at schools like Williams and Columbia, are not able to write as well as they should write when they arrive on campus. And the difficulty is that by the time you get to college, it's late to begin to try to learn those skills. And many schools, again, like Williams and Columbia, do not offer remedial skills, and the students can't make catch up. I want to say another thing, both with the previous caller and with this caller, and it relates to the issue of technology. I think we also need to, ask radical questions, because the situation we're in is a significant, we're facing significant problems. We have to question everything from the structure of departments, as I've indicated, to the structure of the overall curriculum. For instance, why is college 4 years? Why do we require 35 or 32 or whatever courses is? Why are all courses the same length? We may have to rethink all of this in terms of creating a more flexible and adaptable form of education, which then can be supplemented by new forms of alternative education. So we move away from the model of everybody going to college for 4 years.
Interesting. Professor Hacker.
On the simple question of the high schools, and are they letting us down? You know, this is a major industry, both, you know, criticizing the high schools and even criticizing the students. I'm really getting a bit, annoyed at hearing professors criticize their students. They're not prepared. They're not up to the work that I expect of them. My view is, as a doctor says in his office, you take the people who are coming in, your patients, and you deal with them. You take the hand that's dealt with you. And I would say, let the high schools improve, of course, but it's our job at the college level to teach the students we have.
Andrew Hacker, he, with Claudia Dreyfus, is the author of a new book called Higher Education, with a question mark at the end. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Anthony, who's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, you're on the air. Anthony.
Hi, Diane and guests. I just wanted to make a point about tenure. I've been an adjunct professor for 15 years at a local university. And one of the things I found out is when I began teaching, I understood the importance of tenure, because it allows you to challenge your students without fear of consequences, especially in for-profit universities. Because, you know, if you fail someone, ultimately that affects the bottom line, because they won't be back, perhaps, in the next semester. So the tenure is an important tool for quality and allowing you to challenge your students. In my own education, I'll just say that I had a number of professors that, you know, while I was taking their courses, I wanted to strangle them. But once I got through the course, I wanted to thank them because I learned so much. But I had to do it myself a lot of times.
I just made a comment on that, Dan, because this is it's an important point. I just speak anecdotally. In my experience, it's almost 40 years now, I honestly can say I cannot remember one professor who was more willing to speak out on a controversial issue, to take a difficult stand, after tenure than before tenure. I just don't see that as crucial. And I think, as Andrew suggested earlier, in some ways, tenure for the people who don't have it suppresses any possibility of creative or venturesome work, because they're trying to fulfill requirements that have been imposed by others.
Yes, here Mark and I certainly agree on this. There is a whole issue of academic freedom. Will professors with unpopular views be victimized by administrators? We can only say that academic freedom has to be defended at the top by the college president, who believes in it.
And here's a final email from Eden, who says, I find your guests out of touch with the comments about salaries. My husband is a full tenured professor at a state school. I have many friends who teach at private universities. I know very few who make six figures and would like to know why professors should not be making a living wage. Professor Hecker?
I am, Eden, in favor of everybody having a living wage, and if we could arrange a six-figure living wage for everyone, I'd be the first to vote for it.
Andrew Hecker, he's a professor at Queen's College, co-author with Claudia Dreyfus of Higher Education. Mark Taylor is chair of the Department of Religion at Columbia University, professor emeritus at Williams College. He's the author of Crisis on Campus, a most interesting discussion, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Diane.
A real pleasure, Diane.
Thank you, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.